he would not have wasted much thought over it at the moment. It all worried him, and at the same time he could not attend to it. Strange to say, none would have believed it, perhaps, but he only felt a faint, vague anxiety about his immediate future. Another, much more important anxiety tormented him. It concerned himself, but in a different, more vital way. Moreover, he was conscious of immense moral fatigue, though his mind was working better that morning than it had done of late. And was it worthwhile, after all that had happened, to contend with these new trivial difficulties? Was it worthwhile, for instance, to maneuver that Svidrigaïlov should not go to Porfiry's? Was it worthwhile to investigate, to ascertain the facts, to waste time over anyone like Svidrigaïlov? Oh, how sick he was of it all! And yet he was hastening to Svidrigaïlov. Could he be expecting something new from him? Information or means of escape? Men will catch at straws. Was it destiny or some instinct bringing them together? Perhaps it was only fatigue, despair. Perhaps it was not Svidrigaïlov, but some other whom he needed. And Svidrigaïlov had simply presented himself by chance. Sonya? But what should he go to Sonya for now? To beg her tears again? He was afraid of Sonya, too. Sonya stood before him as an irrevocable sentence. He must go his own way, or hers. At that moment especially, he did not feel equal to seeing her. No, wouldn't it be better to try Svidrigaïlov? And he could not help inwardly admitting that he had long felt that he must see him for some reason. But what could they have in common? Their very evil-doing could not be of the same kind. The man, moreover, was very unpleasant, evidently depraved, undoubtedly cunning and deceitful, possibly malignant. Such stories were told about him. It's true he was befriending Katerina Ivanovna's children, but who could tell with what motive and what it meant? The man always had some design, some project. There was another thought which had been continually hovering of late about Raskolnikov's mind and causing him great uneasiness. It was so painful that he made distinct efforts to get rid of it. He sometimes thought that Svidrigaïlov was dogging his footsteps. Svidrigaïlov had found out his secret and had had designs on Dunya. What if he had them still? Wasn't it practically certain that he had? And what if, having learned his secret, and so having gained power over him, he were to use it as a weapon against Dunya? This idea sometimes even tormented his dreams. But it had never presented itself so vividly to him as on his way to Svidrigaïlov. The very thought moved him to gloomy rage. To begin with, this would transform everything, even his own position. He would have at once to confess his secret to Dunya. Would he have to give himself up, perhaps, to prevent Dunya from taking some rash step? The letter? This morning Dunya had received a letter. From whom could she get letters in Petersburg? Luzhin, perhaps? It's true Razumihin was there to protect her, but Razumihin knew nothing of the position. Perhaps it was his duty to tell Razumihin. He thought of it with repugnance. In any case, he must see Svidrigaïlov as soon as possible, he decided finally. Thank God, the details of the interview were of little consequence. If only he could get at the root of the matter, but if Svidrigaïlov were capable, if he were intriguing against Dunya, then... Raskolnikov was so exhausted by what he had passed through that month that he could only decide such questions in one way. Then I shall kill him, he thought in cold despair. A sudden anguish oppressed his heart. He stood still in the middle of the street and began looking about to see where he was and which way he was going. He found himself in X Prospect, 30 or 40 paces from the Haymarket, through which he had come. The whole second story of the house on the left was used as a tavern. All the windows were wide open. Judging from the figures moving at the windows, the rooms were full to overflowing. There were sounds of singing, of clarionet and violin, and the boom of a Turkish drum. He could hear women shrieking. He was about to turn back, wondering why he had come to the X Prospect, when suddenly, at one of the end windows, he saw Svidrigaïlov, sitting at a tea-table right in the open window with a pipe in his mouth. Raskolnikov was dreadfully taken aback, almost terrified. Svidrigaïlov was silently watching and scrutinizing him, and, what struck Raskolnikov at once, seemed to be meaning to get up and slip away unobserved. Raskolnikov at once pretended not to have seen him, but to be looking absent-mindedly away, while he watched him out of the corner of his eye. His heart was beating violently. Yes, it was evident that Svidrigaïlov did not want to be seen. He took the pipe out of his mouth, and was on the point of concealing himself, but as he got up and moved back his chair, he seemed to have become suddenly aware that Raskolnikov had seen him, and was watching him. What had passed between them was much the same as what happened at their first meeting in Raskolnikov's room. A sly smile came into Svidrigaïlov's face and grew broader and broader. Each knew that he was seen and watched by the other. At last Svidrigaïlov broke into a loud laugh.
"Well, well, come in if you want me. I am here," he shouted from the window.
Raskolnikov went up into the tavern. He found Svidrigaïlov in a tiny back room, adjoining the saloon in which merchants, clerks, and numbers of people of all sorts were drinking tea, at 20 little tables to the desperate bawling of a chorus of singers. The click of billiard balls could be heard in the distance. On the table before Svidrigaïlov stood an open bottle and a glass half full of champagne. In the room he found also a boy with a little hand organ. A healthy-looking red-cheeked girl of 18, wearing a tucked-up striped skirt and a Tyrolese hat with ribbons. In spite of the chorus in the other room, she was singing some servants' hall song in a rather husky contralto, to the accompaniment of the organ.
"Come, that's enough,"
Svidrigaïlov stopped her at Raskolnikov's entrance. The girl at once broke off and stood waiting respectfully. She had sung her guttural rhymes, too, with a serious and respectful expression in her face.
"Hey, Philip, a glass!"
shouted Svidrigaïlov. "I won't drink anything," said Raskolnikov.
"As you like, I didn't mean it for you. Drink, Katya. I don't want anything more today. You can go."
He poured her out a full glass and laid down a yellow note. Katya drank off her glass of wine, as women do, without putting it down, in 20 gulps, took the note and kissed Svidrigaïlov's hand, which he allowed quite seriously. She went out of the room, and the boy trailed after her with the organ. Both had been brought in from the street. Svidrigaïlov had not been a week in Petersburg, but everything about him was already, so to speak, on a patriarchal footing. The waiter, Philip, was by now an old friend, and very obsequious. The door leading to the saloon had a lock on it. Svidrigaïlov was at home in this room, and perhaps spent whole days in it. The tavern was dirty and wretched, not even second-rate. "I was going to see you and looking for you," Raskolnikov began, "but I don't know what made me turn from the Haymarket into the X Prospect just now. I never take this turning. I turn to the right from the Haymarket, and this isn't the way to you. I simply turned, and here you are. It is strange."
"Why don't you say at once it's a miracle?"
"Because it may be only chance."
"Oh, that's the way with all you folk," laughed Svidrigaïlov. "You won't admit it even if you do inwardly believe it a miracle. Here you say that it may be only chance. And what cowards they all are here, about having an opinion of their own. You can't imagine, Rodion Romanovitch, I don't mean you. You have an opinion of your own, and are not afraid to have it. That's how it was you attracted my curiosity.
Nothing else?
Well, that's enough, you know.
Svidrigaïlov was obviously exhilarated, but only slightly so. He had not had more than half a glass of wine. I fancy you came to see me before you knew that I was capable of having what you call an opinion of my own, observed Raskolnikov.
Ah, well, it was a different matter. Everyone has his own plans. And apropos of the miracle, let me tell you that I think you have been asleep for the last 2 or 3 days. I told you of this tavern myself. There is no miracle in your coming straight here. I explained the way myself, told you where it was, and the hours you could find me here. Do you remember?
I don't remember, answered Raskolnikov with surprise.
I believe you. I told you twice. The address has been stamped mechanically on your memory. You turned this way mechanically, and yet precisely according to the direction, though you are not aware of it. When I told you then, I hardly hoped you understood me. You give yourself away too much, Rodion Romanovitch. And another thing. I am convinced that there are lots of people in Petersburg who talk to themselves as they walk. This is a town of crazy people. If only we had scientific men, doctors, lawyers, and philosophers might make most valuable investigations in Petersburg, each in his own line. There are few places where there are so many gloomy, strong, and queer influences on the soul of man as in Petersburg. The mere influences of climate mean so much. And it's the administrative center of all Russia, and its character must be reflected on the whole country. But that is neither here nor there. Now, the point is that I have several times watched you. You walk out of your house, holding your head high. 20 paces from home, you let it sink, and fold your hands behind your back. You look and evidently see nothing before nor beside you. At last you begin moving your lips and talking to yourself, and sometimes you wave one hand and declaim, and at last stand still in the middle of the road. That's not at all the thing. Someone may be watching you besides me, and it won't do you any good. It's nothing really to do with me, and I can't cure you, but of course you understand me.
Did you know that I am being followed? Asked Raskolnikov, looking inquisitively at him.
No, I know nothing about it, said Svidrigaïlov, seeming surprised.
Well, then, let's leave me alone, Raskolnikov muttered, frowning.
Very good. Let's leave you alone.
You had better tell me, if you come here to drink, and directed me twice to come here to you, why did you hide? And try to get away just now when I looked at the window from the street. I saw it.
And why was it you lay on your sofa with closed eyes and pretended to be asleep, though you were wide awake while I stood in your doorway? I saw it.
I may have had reasons. You know that yourself.
And I may have had my reasons, though you don't know them.
Raskolnikov dropped his right elbow on the table, leaned his chin in the fingers of his right hand, and stared intently at Svidrigaïlov. For a full minute he scrutinized his face, which had impressed him before. It was a strange face, like a mask, white and red, with bright red lips, with a flaxen beard, and still thick flaxen hair. His eyes were somehow too blue, and their expression somehow too heavy and fixed. There was something awfully unpleasant in that handsome face, which looked so wonderfully young for his age. Svidrigaïlov was smartly dressed, in light summer clothes, and was particularly dainty in his linen. He wore a huge ring with a precious stone in it. "Have I got to bother myself about you too now?" said Raskolnikov suddenly, coming with nervous impatience straight to the point. "Even though perhaps you are the most dangerous man, if you care to injure me, I don't want to put myself out any more. I will show you at once that I don't prize myself as you probably think I do. I've come to tell you at once that if you keep to your former intentions with regard to my sister, and if you think to derive any benefit in that direction from what has been discovered of late, I will kill you before you get me locked up. You can count on my word. You know that I can keep it. And in the second place, if you want to tell me something, for I keep imagining all this time that you have something to tell me, make haste and tell it, for time is precious, and very likely it will soon be too late."
"Why in such haste?"
asked Svidrigailov, looking at him curiously.
"Every one has his plans," Raskolnikov answered gloomily and impatiently.
"You urged me yourself to frankness just now, and at the first question you refuse to answer,"
Svidrigailov observed with a smile.
"You keep fancying that I have aims of my own, and so you look at me with suspicion. Of course, it's perfectly natural in your position. But though I should like to be friends with you, I shan't trouble myself to convince you of the contrary. The game isn't worth the candle, and I wasn't intending to talk to you about anything special."
"What did you want me for, then? It was you who came hanging about me."
"Why, simply as an interesting subject for observation. I liked the fantastic nature of your position. That's what it was. Besides, you are the brother of a person who greatly interested me. And from that person, I had in the past heard a very great deal about you, from which I gathered that you had a great influence over her. Isn't that enough? Still, I must admit that your question is rather complex, and is difficult for me to answer. Here, you, for instance, have come to me not only for a definite reason, but for the sake of hearing something new. Isn't that so? Isn't that so?"
persisted Svidrigailov with a sly smile.
"Well, can't you fancy, then, that I, too, on my way here in the train, was counting on you, on your telling me something new, and on my making some profit out of you? You see what rich men we are."
"What profit could you make?"
"How can I tell you? How do I know? You see in what a tavern I spend all my time, and it's my enjoyment. That's to say, it's no great enjoyment, but one must sit somewhere. That poor Katya now, you saw her? If only I had been a glutton now, a club gourmand. But you see, I can eat this."
He pointed to a little table in the corner, where the remnants of a terrible-looking beefsteak and potatoes lay on a tin dish.
"Have you dined, by the way? I've had something and want nothing more. I don't drink, for instance, at all. Except for champagne, I never touch anything. And not more than a glass of that all the evening. And even that is enough to make my head ache. I ordered it just now to wind myself up, for I am just going off somewhere, and you see me in a peculiar state of mind. That was why I hid myself just now, like a schoolboy, for I was afraid you would hinder me. But I believe—"
he pulled out his watch—
I can spend an hour with you. It's 4:30 now. If only I'd been something, a landowner, a father, a cavalry officer, a photographer, a journalist. I am nothing. No specialty. And sometimes I am positively bored. I really thought you would tell me something new.
But what are you? And why have you come here?
What am I? You know, a gentleman. I served for 2 years in the cavalry. Then I knocked about here in Petersburg. Then I married Marfa Petrovna and lived in the country. There. You have my biography.
You are a gambler, I believe.
No. A poor sort of gambler, a card sharper, not a gambler.
You have been a card sharper, then?
Yes. I've been a card sharper, too.
Didn't you get thrashed sometimes?
It did happen. Why?
Why, you might have challenged them. Altogether, it must have been lively.
I won't contradict you, and besides, I am no hand at philosophy. I confess that I hastened here for the sake of the women.
As soon as you buried Marfa Petrovna?
Quite so.
Svidrigailov smiled with engaging candor.
What of it? You seem to find something wrong in my speaking like that about women.
You ask whether I find anything wrong in vice?
Vice? Oh, that's what you are after. But I'll answer you in order, first about women in general. You know I am fond of talking. Tell me, what should I restrain myself for? Why should I give up women, since I have a passion for them? It's an occupation, anyway.
So, you hope for nothing here but vice?
Oh, very well, for vice, then. You insist on its being vice. But anyway, I like a direct question. In this vice, at least, there is something permanent, founded indeed upon nature, and not dependent on fantasy. Something present in the blood, like an ever-burning ember, forever setting one on fire, and maybe not to be quickly extinguished, even with years. You'll agree it's an occupation of a sort.
That's nothing to rejoice at. It's a disease, and a dangerous one.
Oh, that's what you think, is it? I agree that it is a disease like everything that exceeds moderation. And, of course, in this, one must exceed moderation. But in the first place, everybody does so in one way or another, and in the second place, of course, one ought to be moderate and prudent, however mean it may be. But what am I to do? If I hadn't this, I might have to shoot myself. I am ready to admit that a decent man ought to put up with being bored, but yet...
And could you shoot yourself?
Oh, come... Svidrigailov parried with disgust. "Please don't speak of it,"
he added hurriedly, and with none of the bragging tone he had shown in all the previous conversation. His face quite changed.
"I admit it's an unpardonable weakness, but I can't help it. I am afraid of death, and I dislike its being talked of. Do you know that I am to a certain extent a mystic?"
The apparitions of Marfa Petrovna. Do they still go on visiting you?
Oh, don't talk of them. There have been no more in Petersburg. Confound them!
He cried with an air of irritation.
Let's rather talk of that. Though, I have not much time and can't stay long with you. It's a pity. I should have found plenty to tell you.
What's your engagement? A woman?
Yes, a woman. a casual incident. No, that's not what I want to talk of.
And the hideousness? The filthiness of all your surroundings, doesn't that affect you? Have you lost the strength to stop yourself?
And do you pretend to strength, too? You surprised me just now, Rodion Romanovitch, though I knew beforehand it would be so. You preach to me about vice and aesthetics. You, a Schiller. You, an idealist. Of course, that's all as it should be, and it would be surprising if it were not so. Yet it is strange in reality. Ah, what a pity I have no time, for you are a most interesting type. And by the way, are you fond of Schiller? I am awfully fond of him.
But what a braggart you are, Raskolnikov said with some disgust.
Upon my word, I am not, answered Svidrigailov, laughing. However, I won't dispute it. Let me be a braggart. Why not brag if it hurts no one? I spent 7 years in the country with Marfa Petrovna, so now when I come across an intelligent person like you, intelligent and highly interesting, I am simply glad to talk, and besides, I've drunk that half glass of champagne, and it's gone to my head a little. And besides, there's a certain fact that has wound me up tremendously. But about that I will keep quiet. Where are you off to? He asked in alarm.
Raskolnikov had begun getting up. He felt oppressed and stifled, and, as it were, ill at ease at having come here. He felt convinced that Svidrigailov was the most worthless scoundrel on the face of the earth.
"Ah, sit down, stay a little," Svidrigailov begged. "Let them bring you some tea anyway. Stay a little, I won't talk nonsense, about myself, I mean. I'll tell you something. If you like, I'll tell you how a woman tried to save me, as you would call it. It will be an answer to your first question, indeed, for the woman was your sister. May I tell you? It will help to spend the time.
Tell me. But I trust that you...
Oh, don't be uneasy. Besides, even in a worthless, low fellow like me, Avdotya Romanovna can only excite the deepest respect.
Chapter 4.
You know, perhaps, yes, I told you myself, began Svidrigailov, that I was in the debtor's prison here for an immense sum and had not any expectation of being able to pay it. There's no need to go into particulars of how Marfa Petrovna bought me out. Do you know to what a point of insanity a woman can sometimes love? She was an honest woman, and very sensible, although completely uneducated. Would you believe that this honest and jealous woman, after many scenes of hysterics and reproaches, condescended to enter into a kind of contract with me, which she kept throughout our married life? She was considerably older than I, and besides, she always kept a clove or something in her mouth. There was so much swinishness in my soul, and honesty, too, of a sort, as to tell her straight out that I couldn't be absolutely faithful to her. This confession drove her to frenzy, but yet she seems in a way to have liked my brutal frankness. She thought it showed I was unwilling to deceive her if I warned her like this beforehand. And for a jealous woman, you know, that's the first consideration. After many tears, an unwritten contract was drawn up between us. First, that I would never leave Marfa Petrovna, and would always be her husband. Secondly, that I would never absent myself without her permission. Thirdly, that I would never set up a permanent mistress. Fourthly, in return for this Marfa Petrovna gave me a free hand with the maidservants, but only with her secret knowledge. Fifthly, God forbid my falling in love with a woman of our class. Sixthly, in case I, which God forbid, should be visited by a great serious passion, I was bound to reveal it to Marfa Petrovna. On this last score, however, Marfa Petrovna was fairly at ease. She was a sensible woman, and so she could not help looking upon me as a dissolute profligate incapable of real love. But a sensible woman and a jealous woman are two very different things, and that's where the trouble came in. But to judge some people impartially, we must renounce certain preconceived opinions and our habitual attitude to the ordinary people about us. I have reason to have faith in your judgment rather than in anyone's. Perhaps you have already heard a great deal that was ridiculous and absurd about Marfa Petrovna. She certainly had some very ridiculous ways, but I tell you frankly that I feel really sorry for the innumerable woes of which I was the cause. Well, and that's enough, I think, by way of a decorous oraison funèbre for the most tender wife of a most tender husband. When we quarrelled, I usually held my tongue and did not irritate her, and that gentlemanly conduct rarely failed to attain its object. It influenced her, it pleased her indeed. These were times when she was positively proud of me. But your sister, she couldn't put up with anyway. And however she came to risk taking such a beautiful creature into her house as a governess. My explanation is that Marfa Petrovna was an ardent and impressionable woman, and simply fell in love herself. Literally fell in love with your sister. Well, little wonder. Look at Avdotya Romanovna. I saw the danger at the first glance. And what do you think? I resolved not to look at her even. But Avdotya Romanovna herself made the first step. Would you believe it? Would you believe it, too, that Marfa Petrovna was positively angry with me at first for my persistent silence about your sister? For my careless reception of her continual adoring praises of Avdotya Romanovna. I don't know what it was she wanted. Well, of course, Marfa Petrovna told Avdotya Romanovna every detail about me. She had the unfortunate habit of telling literally everyone all our family secrets, and continually complaining of me. How could she fail to confide in such a delightful new friend? I expect they talked of nothing else but me, and no doubt Avdotya Romanovna heard all those dark, mysterious rumours that were current about me. I don't mind betting that you, too, have heard something of the sort already.
I have. Luzhin charged you with having caused the death of a child. Is that true?
Don't refer to those vulgar tales, I beg, said Svidrigailov with disgust and annoyance. If you insist on wanting to know about all that idiocy, I will tell you one day. But now...
I was told, too, about some footman of yours in the country, whom you treated badly.
I beg you to drop the subject,
Svidrigailov interrupted again with obvious impatience. Was that the footman who came to you after death to fill your pipe? You told me about it yourself.
Raskolnikov felt more and more irritated.
Svidrigailov looked at him attentively, and Raskolnikov fancied he caught a flash of spiteful mockery in that look.
But Svidrigailov restrained himself and answered very civilly.
"Yes, it was. I see that you, too, are extremely interested and shall feel it my duty to satisfy your curiosity at the first opportunity. Upon my soul. I see that I really might pass for a romantic figure with some people. Judge how grateful I must be to Marfa Petrovna for having repeated to Avdotya Romanovna such mysterious and interesting gossip about me. I dare not guess what impression it made on her. But in any case, it worked in my interests. With all Avdotya Romanovna's natural aversion, and in spite of my invariably gloomy and repellent aspect, she did at least feel pity for me. Pity for a lost soul. And if once a girl's heart is moved to pity, it's more dangerous than anything. She is bound to want to save him, to bring him to his senses, and lift him up and draw him to nobler aims, and restore him to new life and usefulness. Well, we all know how far such dreams can go. I saw at once that the bird was flying into the cage of herself. And I, too, made ready. I think you are frowning, Rodion Romanovitch. There's no need, as you know, it all ended in smoke. Hang it all, what a lot I am drinking. Do you know, I always, from the very beginning, regretted that it wasn't your sister's fate to be born in the second or third century A.D., as the daughter of a reigning prince, or some governor, or proconsul in Asia Minor. She would undoubtedly have been one of those who would endure martyrdom and would have smiled when they branded her bosom with hot pincers. And she would have gone to it of herself. And in the fourth or fifth century, she would have walked away into the Egyptian desert and would have stayed there 30 years, living on roots and ecstasies and visions. She is simply thirsting to face some torture for someone. And if she can't get her torture, she'll throw herself out of a window. I've heard something of a Mr. Razumihin. He's said to be a sensible fellow. His surname suggests it, indeed. He's probably a divinity student. Well, he'd better look after your sister. I believe I understand her, and I am proud of it. But at the beginning of an acquaintance, as you know, one is apt to be more heedless and stupid. One doesn't see clearly. Hang it all. Why is she so handsome? It's not my fault. In fact, it began on my side with a most irresistible physical desire. Avdotya Romanovna is awfully chaste. Incredibly and phenomenally so. Take note, I tell you this about your sister as a fact. She is almost morbidly chaste, in spite of her broad intelligence. And it will stand in her way. There happened to be a girl in the house then. Parasha, a black-eyed wench whom I had never seen before. She had just come from another village. Very pretty, but incredibly stupid. She burst into tears, wailed so that she could be heard all over the place, and caused scandal. One day after dinner, Avdotya Romanovna followed me into an avenue in the garden, and with flashing eyes, insisted on my leaving poor Parasha alone. It was almost our first conversation by ourselves. I, of course, was only too pleased to obey her wishes. Tried to appear disconcerted, embarrassed. In fact, played my part not badly. Then came interviews, mysterious conversations, exhortations, entreaties, supplications, even tears. Would you believe it? Even tears. Think what the passion for propaganda will bring some girls to. I, of course, threw it all on my destiny, posed as hungering and thirsting for light, and finally resorted to the most powerful weapon in the subjection of the female heart. A weapon which never fails one. It's the well-known resource. Flattery. Nothing in the world is harder than speaking the truth, and nothing easier than flattery. If there's the 100th part of a false note in speaking the truth, it leads to a discord, and that leads to trouble. But if all, to the last note, is false in flattery, it is just as agreeable, and is heard not without satisfaction. It may be a coarse satisfaction, but still a satisfaction. And however coarse the flattery, at least half will be sure to seem true. That's so for all stages of development and classes of society. A Vestal Virgin might be seduced by flattery. I can never remember without laughter how I once seduced a lady who was devoted to her husband, her children, and her principles. What fun it was, and how little trouble. And the lady really had principles of her own, anyway. All my tactics lay in simply being utterly annihilated and prostrate before her purity. I flattered her shamelessly, and as soon as I succeeded in getting a pressure of the hand, even a glance from her, I would reproach myself for having snatched it by force, and would declare that she had resisted, so that I could never have gained anything but for my being so unprincipled. I maintained that she was so innocent that she could not foresee my treachery, and yielded to me unconsciously, unawares, and so on. In fact, I triumphed, while my lady remained firmly convinced that she was innocent, chaste, and faithful to all her duties and obligations, and had succumbed quite by accident. And how angry she was with me when I explained to her at last that it was my sincere conviction that she was just as eager as I. Poor Marfa Petrovna was awfully weak on the side of flattery, and if I had only cared to, I might have had all her property settled on me during her lifetime. I am drinking an awful lot of wine now, and talking too much. I hope you won't be angry if I mention now that I was beginning to produce the same effect on Avdotya Romanovna. But I was stupid and impatient, and spoiled it all. Avdotya Romanovna had several times, and one time in particular, been greatly displeased by the expression of my eyes, would you believe it? There was sometimes a light in them which frightened her, and grew stronger and stronger and more unguarded till it was hateful to her. No need to go into detail, but we parted. There I acted stupidly again. I fell to jeering in the coarsest way at all such propaganda and efforts to convert me. Parasha came on to the scene again, and not she alone. In fact, there was a tremendous to-do. Ah, Rodion Romanovitch, if you could only see how your sister's eyes can flash sometimes. Never mind my being drunk at this moment and having had a whole glass of wine. I am speaking the truth. I assure you that this glance has haunted my dreams. The very rustle of her dress was more than I could stand at last. I really began to think that I might become epileptic. I could never have believed that I could be moved to such a frenzy. It was essential, indeed, to be reconciled, but by then it was impossible. And imagine what I did then. To what a pitch of stupidity a man can be brought by frenzy! Never undertake anything in a frenzy, Rodion Romanovitch. I reflected that Avdotya Romanovna was, after all, a beggar. Ugh, excuse me, that's not the word. But does it matter if it expresses the meaning? That she lived by her work. That she had her mother and you to keep. Ugh, hang it, you are frowning again. And I resolved to offer her all my money, 30,000 rubles I could have realized then, if she would run away with me here, to Petersburg. Of course I should have vowed eternal love, rapture, and so on. Do you know, I was so wild about her at that time that if she had told me to poison Marfa Petrovna, or to cut her throat, and to marry herself, it would have been done at once. But it ended in the catastrophe of which you know already. You can fancy how frantic I was when I heard that Marfa Petrovna had got hold of that scoundrelly attorney, Luzhin, and had almost made a match between them, which would really have been just the same thing as I was proposing. Wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? I notice that you've begun to be very attentive. You interesting young man.
Svidrigailov struck the table with his fist, impatiently. He was flushed. Raskolnikov saw clearly that the glass, or glass and a half of champagne that he had sipped almost unconsciously, was affecting him, and he resolved to take advantage of the opportunity. He felt very suspicious of Svidrigailov.
"Well, after what you have said, I'm fully convinced that you have come to Petersburg with designs on my sister," he said directly to Svidrigailov, in order to irritate him further.
"Oh, nonsense," said Svidrigailov, seeming to rouse himself. "Why, I told you. Besides, your sister can't endure me."
"Yes, I am certain that she can't. But that's not the point."
"Are you so sure that she can't?"
Svidrigailov screwed up his eyes and smiled mockingly.
"You are right. She doesn't love me, but you can never be sure of what has passed between husband and wife, or lover and mistress. There's always a little corner which remains a secret to the world, and is only known to those two. Will you answer for it, that Avdotya Romanovna regarded me with aversion?"
"From some words you've dropped, I notice that you still have designs, and of course evil ones, on Dunya, and mean to carry them out promptly."
"What? Have I dropped words like that?"
Svidrigailov asked in naive dismay, taking not the slightest notice of the epithet bestowed on his designs. "Why, you are dropping them even now. Why are you so frightened? What are you so afraid of now?"
"Me? Afraid? Afraid of you? You have rather to be afraid of me, cher ami. But what nonsense! I've drunk too much, though I see that. I was almost saying too much again. Damn the wine! Hey, there, water!"
He snatched up the champagne bottle and flung it without ceremony out of the window. Philip brought the water.
"That's all nonsense," said Svidrigailov,
wetting a towel and putting it to his head.
"But I can answer you in one word, and annihilate all your suspicions. Do you know that I am going to get married?"
"You told me so before."
"Did I? I've forgotten. But I couldn't have told you so for certain, for I had not even seen my betrothed. I only meant to. But now I really have a betrothed, and it's a settled thing. And if it weren't that I have business that can't be put off, I would have taken you to see them at once, for I should like to ask your advice. Ugh, hang it, only 10 minutes left. See, look at the watch. But I must tell you, for it's an interesting story, my marriage, in its own way. Where are you off to? Going again?
No. I'm not going away now.
Not at all. We shall see. I'll take you there. I'll show you my betrothed. Only not now. For you'll soon have to be off. You have to go to the right and I to the left. Do you know that Madame Reslich, the woman I am lodging with now, eh? I know what you're thinking, that she's the woman whose girl, they say, drowned herself in the winter. Come, are you listening? She arranged it all for me. You're bored, she said. You want something to fill up your time. For you know I am a gloomy, depressed person. Do you think I'm light-hearted? No, I'm gloomy. I do no harm but sit in a corner without speaking a word for 3 days at a time. And that Reslich is a sly hussy, I tell you. I know what she has got in her mind. She thinks I shall get sick of it, abandon my wife and depart, and she'll get hold of her and make a profit out of her, in our class, of course, or higher. She told me the father was a broken-down retired official, who has been sitting in a chair for the last 3 years with his legs paralyzed. The mama, she said, was a sensible woman. There is a son serving in the provinces, but he doesn't help. There is a daughter who is married, but she doesn't visit them. And they've two little nephews on their hands, as though their own children were not enough. And they've taken from school their youngest daughter, a girl who'll be 16 in another month, so that then she can be married. She was for me. We went there. How funny it was. I present myself, a landowner, a widower, of a well-known name, with connections, with a fortune. What if I am 50 and she is not 16? Who thinks of that? But it's fascinating, isn't it? It is fascinating. You should have seen how I talked to the papa and mama. It was worth paying to have seen me at that moment. She comes in, curtsies, you can fancy, still in a short frock, an unopened bud, flushing like a sunset. She had been told, no doubt. I don't know how you feel about female faces, but to my mind, these 16 years, these childish eyes, shyness, and tears of bashfulness, are better than beauty. And she is a perfect little picture, too. Fair hair and little curls, like a lamb's. Full little rosy lips, tiny feet. A charmer. Well, we made friends. I told them I was in a hurry, owing to domestic circumstances, and the next day, that is the day before yesterday, we were betrothed. When I go now, I take her on my knee at once, and keep her there. Well, she flushes like a sunset, and I kiss her every minute. Her mamma, of course, impresses on her that this is her husband and that this must be so. It's simply delicious. The present betrothed condition is perhaps better than marriage. Here you have what is called la nature et la vérité. I've talked to her twice. She is far from a fool. Sometimes she steals a look at me that positively scorches me. Her face is like Raphael's Madonna. You know, the Sistine Madonna's face has something fantastic in it. The face of mournful, religious ecstasy. Haven't you noticed it? Well, she's something in that line. The day after we'd been betrothed, I bought her presents to the value of 1,500 rubles, a set of diamonds, and another of pearls, and a silver dressing-case as large as this, with all sorts of things in it, so that even my Madonna's face glowed. I sat her on my knee yesterday, and I suppose rather too unceremoniously. She flushed crimson, and the tears started. But she didn't want to show it. We were left alone. She suddenly flung herself on my neck, for the first time of her own accord, put her little arms round me, kissed me, and vowed that she would be an obedient, faithful, and good wife, would make me happy, would devote all her life, every minute of her life, would sacrifice everything, everything, and that all she asks in return is my respect, and that she wants nothing, nothing more from me, no presents. You'll admit that to hear such a confession, alone, from an angel of 16, in a muslin frock, with little curls, with a flush of maiden shyness in her cheeks, and tears of enthusiasm in her eyes, is rather fascinating. Isn't it fascinating? It's worth paying for, isn't it? Well, listen, we'll go to see my betrothed, only not just now.
The fact is, this monstrous difference in age and development excites your sensuality. Will you really make such a marriage?
Why, of course. Everyone thinks of himself, and he lives most gaily who knows best how to deceive himself. But why are you so keen about virtue? Have mercy on me, my good friend. I am a sinful man.
But you have provided for the children of Katerina Ivanovna. Though you had your own reasons, I understand it all now.
I am always fond of children, very fond of them,
laughed Svidrigailov.
I can tell you one curious instance of it. The first day I came here, I visited various haunts. After 7 years, I simply rushed at them. You probably notice that I am not in a hurry to renew acquaintance with my old friends. I shall do without them as long as I can. Do you know, when I was with Marfa Petrovna in the country, I was haunted by the thought of these places where anyone who knows his way about can find a great deal. Yes, upon my soul.
The peasants have vodka. The educated young people, shut out from activity, waste themselves in impossible dreams and visions and are crippled by theories. Jews have sprung up and are amassing money. And all the rest give themselves up to debauchery. From the first hour the town reeked of its familiar odours. I chanced to be in a frightful den. I like my dens dirty. It was a dance, so-called. And there was a can-can such as I never saw in my day. Yes, there you have progress. All of a sudden I saw a little girl of 13, nicely dressed, dancing with a specialist in that line, with another one vis-à-vis. Her mother was sitting on a chair by the wall. You can't imagine what a can-can that was. The girl was ashamed, blushed, at last felt insulted and began to cry. Her partner seized her and began whirling her round and performing before her. Everyone laughed, and I like your public, even the can-can public. They laughed and shouted, "Serves her right! Serves her right! Shouldn't bring children!" Well, it's not my business whether that consoling reflection was logical or not. I at once fixed on my plan, sat down by the mother, and began by saying that I, too, was a stranger, and that people here were ill-bred, and that they couldn't distinguish decent folks and treat them with respect. Gave her to understand that I had plenty of money, offered to take them home in my carriage. I took them home, and got to know them. They were lodging in a miserable little hole, and had only just arrived from the country. She told me that she and her daughter could only regard my acquaintance as an honour. I found out that they had nothing of their own, and had come to town upon some legal business. I proffered my services and money. I learnt that they had gone to the dancing saloon by mistake, believing that it was a genuine dancing class. I offered to assist in the young girl's education, in French, and dancing. My offer was accepted with enthusiasm, as an honour. And we are still friendly. If you like, we'll go and see them, only not just now. Stop! Enough of your vile, nasty anecdotes, depraved, vile, sensual man!
Schiller, you are a regular Schiller. Oh, la vertu va-t-elle se nicher? But you know I shall tell you these things on purpose, for the pleasure of hearing your outcries.